Let's begin. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. Tonight, we are fortunate to have Martin Gayford here from Cambridge, England. After studying philosophy at Cambridge and art history at the University of London's Courtauld Institute, Martin has had a distinguished career as a writer and critic, writing prolifically about art and music and jazz in particular. Contributing regularly to the Daily Telegraph, various art magazines, and exhibition catalogs, Martin was art critic of The Spectator until 2002, as well as The Sunday Telegraph, and he is currently chief art critic for Bloomberg News. Where recent articles and reviews, I think, are interesting because I think they give us a sense of Martin's range. The ones I saw as I was looking through, for example, most recently, they range from a report on the current Turner Prize exhibition at Tate Britain, which is actually quite entertaining, Martin's writing on that, to an upcropping of the Mona Lisa, to a piece titled Coon's Basketball Meets Drunken Hercules, which is a piece about the exhibition Bronze at the Royal Academy. In addition, Martin has written numerous books, including The Yellow House, Van Gogh, Gauguin, and Nine Turbulent Weeks in Provence, which was met with critical acclaim in this country as well as in Britain in 2008, and has to date been translated into 5 languages. Also, the intriguing Constable in Love, as well as John Constable Portraits, an exhibition catalog for the exhibition of the same name, which Martin, who by all accounts is also a curator, co-curated with Anne Lyles in 2009 for the National Portrait Gallery in London. And most recently, his book, On David Hockney, A Bigger Message, Conversations with David Hockney, which was published last year, 2011. Of course, we all know Martin Gayford to be the man with a blue scarf, the subject of Lucian Freud's compelling painting currently found in Gallery 7 in Lucian Freud Portraits, which is, of course, the Modern's current exhibition. I'm certain that everyone here tonight is also aware that the experience of sitting for that remarkable portrait is the subject of Martin Gayford's 2010 book, Man with a Blue Scarf, on sitting for a portrait by Lucian Freud, which I hope you purchased tonight or earlier from the Modern's bookstore and had the opportunity to have a sign by Martin at the book signing just prior to the lecture. Of course, that brings us to Martin's having graciously agreed to come all this way to share his observations, insights, and experiences of that extended exchange with Lucian Freud for this Tuesday evening's presentation. I know you're as anxious to get to it as I am, so please join me in welcoming Martin Gayford.
Well, thank you, Terry. Thank you all for coming. It's great to see you here. I'm really enjoying my first visit to Fort Worth, Dallas. Never been here before. It's not my first visit to Texas. What we're looking at here is Lucian's palette as it sat on a stool beside the window in the summer of 2010. I just saw it. I was in the studio visiting him and looking at actually the last picture in the exhibition, Portrait of the Hound. He popped out of the room and I just saw that looking there, very pretty on the chair. So I snapped it with my iPhone. It's the only photograph by me you'll see in this lecture this evening. All the rest of our David Dawson. I've included it partly since Lucian died last year as a sort of exactly a tribute, is a memory of him. Almost the first thing he said to me when I met him, one of his earlier confessions was that he'd worked out what his last picture was going to be. He described the subject. It was going to be his palette, abandoned, thrown in the corner of the studio amongst the rags lying there. Well, that sort of thing is very difficult to organise, especially if you're, especially if your pictures can take up to a year to paint. So he never got round to painting his last picture. However, this is a sort of substitute for it. And also it introduces what you might call a chromatic anecdote. That is a little story about colour, which I'm going to tell you to introduce my talk this evening, and it concerns this, my prop, which I've brought. I'd like to go back to, I suppose it was about the middle of April 2004, at which point I'd been sitting for 6 months, 1, 2, 3 nights a week, always wearing the same clothes, a pink shirt, tweed jacket, this scarf, and in all that time, Lucien had painted nothing of the blue scarf at all. Because, as I'll explain more about his method later on, but the painting was slowly expanding from a central point, and when you were a sitter for Lucien, actually any progress you greeted with enthusiasm. So, you know, you'd think, oh, great, he started on the collar. Or, you know, tiny developments were encouraging. And it had been announced at the previous sitting that he was about to start on the blue scarf. So this was a big moment, especially as the blue is a slightly unusual colour in his palette. Lucien did not like bright and beautiful colours. Every painter has their own characteristic gamut of colours. So a colour which would be completely standard in the palette of, I don't know, Hockney or Matisse was very, very unusual in Lucien's palette. He would actually say, for example, the reason why he didn't take drugs, he would say, is he'd heard that taking drugs made you see beautiful colours. And he'd say, I don't want to see beautiful colours. I want to see the same colours all the time. This, however, accepted it as part of the picture, but he would say, sort of reflectively, I don't like beautiful colours, but that is a beautiful colour. So, anyway, it was an exciting moment, and I sat there, and Lucien, after revving himself up to start the sitting, he mixed one consignment of blue and advanced to the canvas, looked at me, advanced to the canvas. No, that wasn't right. Mixed up another lot. Same thing happened 2, 3, 4 times. Eventually he said, I've obviously gone mad. It's me. I just can't paint this blue this evening. I'll do something else. So he spent the rest of the evening painting a bit of sort of brown air above my head. I went home. I live outside London, about 60 miles away in a town called Cambridge, so I always had a journey after the sitting. I went home and I told this strange occurrence to my wife, and she said, which blue scarf were you wearing? And I said, what? And she said, you do know you've got two blue scarves, don't you? And I said, no. Nobody's ever told me that. I had no idea that I had two blue scarves. It transpired that I had this one. This has been checked by my wife. This is the correct one. Before I put it in the suitcase to bring it. And another one, which is just about half a tone darker. It's got a bit of black in it. And somehow, for 6 months, I'd managed to get this one out of the drawer and bring it to every sitting. And for the crucial evening, I'd put the wrong one on. So I digested this information. I decided that probably the best thing was not to mention it to the artist for the time being. So I put on the right blue scarf and went back the next week, and Lucien started painting the blue scarf, and everything was absolutely fine. I've told this story before to audiences, and a couple of times ago, somebody afterwards said, well, what would have happened if your wife hadn't known about that scarf? Would the picture actually have just stopped at that point? And I think it might have done. And the point I want to extract, let's have a look at the picture, is that I think this is a remarkable example of the artist's eye and how it works. Because what I deduce must have happened is that for all those 6 months while Lucien was painting my face, which looked at the time like a mosaic of khaki, oatmeal, lime green, all sorts of unexpected colours, which all actually were knocked back as soon as the blue went in. He had in mind this precise shade of blue, so they were all keyed to this blue. Consequently, when I turned up wearing the wrong colour, it threw him completely, which I think is, is an interesting... I wouldn't have guessed that an artist would operate quite like that, but actually other painters have told me, yes, that is exactly what it's like. That's perfectly plausible. So, at this point, I'm going to track back a bit to explain a bit about how I came to be in this position, predicament, or have this wonderful opportunity, depending on how you choose to look at it, of sitting for Lucien Freud for all those months, wearing the scarf and the tweed jacket and so forth. I had met him about 8 years before. He sent me a postcard, which is quite a rare item, because one thing Lucien didn't do very much was write. Consequently, anyone writing his biography is going to be up against a considerable difficulty in finding evidence, because I've seen his correspondence. It reads, in not joined up letters, would you like to meet for lunch next Wednesday, that kind of thing. Anyway, I got one of those postcards. He'd read something that I'd written, and so we met for lunch, and everything went fine, and we seemed to get on, and we got into a rhythm of every month or two he'd invite me out or say, well, I'd like to come and look at his new picture or something like that. And after a while, in an attempt to return this hospitality, I started inviting him out as, I suppose you'd have to say, my date. To music concerts. As Terry said, I was the jazz critic of a London newspaper at the time. And when you're a music critic, you always get two tickets. So previously, I'd just put my notebook down on the spare seat or something like that. But I thought, well, actually, Lucien really likes certain kinds of jazz, so I could invite him along. So I took him to... We saw some very good things, actually. I took him to see Wynton Marsalis and Cassandra Wilson, and we went to see Ray Charles at the Festival Hall. And Lucien always had a distinctive... his reaction. For example, Ray Charles, tremendous evening, great big band. Ray Charles in very good form. He stopped the whole concert and had a row with the sound man halfway through. Very exciting. We walked out, and Lucien said, he really knows how to wear clothes, doesn't he? So, Lucien was very interested. I mean, he painted a lot of naked people. He was pretty interested in the way people were dressed as well and how it reflected their personality. So, Ray Charles and his jacket and his trousers had been what Lucien had been focusing on for the whole evening. And this went on and on. And at the back of my mind, I began to formulate the idea that it would be a very interesting thing to sit, to be a subject for one of his paintings. But it took me years to get round to raising the subject because it seemed a bit slightly embarrassing and look at me, what about me, sort of thing. And so one afternoon at the end of 2003, I think it was October, I was sitting in his kitchen having tea. And I somehow managed to pluck up the courage, and I rather pessimistically I said something, hesitant, probably along the lines of, if you thought I would be an interesting subject, I think I'd be able to find the time to come along for the sittings. And I expected he'd say, that's a nice idea, maybe one of these days we could do that. And instead he said, excellent, what are you doing next Tuesday evening? And so, bang, I was almost immediately locked into that position, in that chair. That's the setup for the picture. Just say a few things about how it worked technically. The first thing we did on the very first evening was Lucien got down on his hands and knees and drew chalk marks around the legs of that chair as soon as we'd fixed my position. And every evening for the next 8 months, for every sitting, the first thing we did was crawl around on the floor trying to find these chalk marks, which became increasingly difficult, as you can imagine, so we could fix the position of the seat, which fixed my position, because the crucial thing was that the easel and the chair with me in it and the light, which you can just about see the edge of it at the top of that slide, but there was a 500 watt halogen bulb above the easel, and that had to be in the same relative position as well. And the other thing was, it always had to happen at night by artificial light, because there's a distinction which you might not notice just walking through an exhibition such as this marvelous exhibition here, which is that Lucien's paintings were all distinguished according to the time of day they were done, because light was very important. If a painting started as a morning picture, it always had to carry on as a morning picture. Afternoon picture, same. A night picture done by artificial light, completely impossible for him to put a stroke of paint on the canvas except at night. So that was one thing. Well, I was also introduced early on to the idea that that by which he meant me and him, are here to help it. I.e. there are three of us in the studio, and the most important one is the painting. I'll just give you this unfinished picture of Francis Bacon from about 1958 gives you an idea of how a Freud developed, which he had a method which was certainly unusual. Another leading figurative painter has described it to me as completely crazy, but that's maybe going a bit far. But Lucien, a lot of figurative painters would start with a sort of sketchy overall beginning, and then things would slowly get into focus. Lucien tended to start with a blob in the middle of the picture. Or on the first evening, what he did was do a charcoal drawing on the canvas. You can just about see there the vestiges of the charcoal drawing he was following there. So first evening, he drew my head on the canvas. Next time, he got out the palette and the mixed up a blob of flesh colour and started in the middle of my forehead. And for the following 4 or 5 months, the paint slowly moved out from my forehead, so that the blob was the beginning of November. By Christmas, there were two eyebrows and a pair of eyes and a nose looking out from the canvas. My wife came and had a look at it. We went out and had dinner together with Lucien, and she looked at the picture first and she said, it looks like you. I said, how can you possibly tell? It's just, anyway. So he had this odd method that the painting slowly advanced from the middle. And as you can see in his last unfinished picture of the Portrait of the Hound, which is in this show, when a picture was getting close to being finished, he'd just have a few corners of unpainted canvas around the edges, which he liked to keep, just as a sign to him that the thing wasn't finished yet. And when all the canvas was gone, covered by paint, that was a good sign that you were within, at any rate, a month or so of finishing the picture. So here's this is the the sitter's point of view, so to speak. That's pretty much what I saw, except that this was taken by David Dawson, who was posing at the time with a dog sitting on his lap, in the hot summer of 2006. And so Lucien had his shirt off, but usually he was wearing the shirt. But otherwise, the extraordinary array of brushes looking like the feathers of a bird sticking out of jars all over the studio, piles of squeezed, half-squeezed paint tubes, which he spent a lot of time searching through, looking for exactly the right tube that he wanted, exactly the right brush. And mysteriously, they never seemed to dry up. And at night, the brushes didn't get dry, and the paint was always used. But there were certain rituals which left marks on the room. The room, the studio, he had two studios he worked in at that time. The one I was sitting in was on the first floor, in English terms, that sort of upstairs, in his house in Kensington, which was a perfectly preserved house built in 1750. And Lucien had done very little to it. Some of the rooms where he lived were rather beautifully, sparely decorated. This room, he just moved in and used his studio. And he did what he always did in his studios, which is every time he cleaned his palette with a palette knife, he would clean it off and whack it on the wall. So that arrangement of paint in the background, which looks a little bit like an abstract Tachiste painting, which might have been painted, say, in Paris in 1956, is in fact, although rather beautiful, completely accidental. I'll say just a word about Lucien's career prior to all this, how he ended up in the studio. He was born on the 8th of December 1922 in Berlin. He was the grandson of Sigmund Freud. His father was Ernst Freud, Sigmund Freud's second son, and he was the second son of Ernst, in fact. And he grew up until he was about 10 in Weimar, Germany. So he swapped the cigarette cards, if anyone here can remember those, and toy soldiers in the Potsdamer Platz, the old Potsdamer Platz, and fell through the ice in the Tiergarten one day when he was skating, he told me, which very characteristically, instead of remembering as a terrifying ordeal, he described as rather exciting. Anyway, so his family, prudently, as soon as the Nazi regime came to power, almost instantly felt that things were becoming very dangerous and left. So they arrived in London in 1933, with all their possessions, and effected quite a sort of easy transition, although a bit of a culture shock, I imagine. And Lucien went consequently to a succession of English public, what we call public schools, which means, in fact, private schools, from almost all of which he was expelled for one reason or another. At Bryanston, which was the last school he went to in Dorset, he... near Bournemouth, he, among other things, arranged for the local fox hunt to ride through the school dining hall. So something which I didn't discover, actually, he didn't tell me. Anyway, he was a bit of a handful, in fact, as a teenager, and only wanted to be a painter. So he, at 16, he set about studying art full-time, and... consequently, he had an amazingly long career as an artist. The first painting in his 2002 Tate retrospective was dated 1939. The last unfinished picture, 2011. That's, what, 72 years of painting, an awful lot of which he spent looking at live human, sometimes animal, models. So... I mean, there are other epic careers in art, you know, Picasso, Michelangelo, Titian. There are people who carried on doing it for a very long time. I think it's possible nobody else spent quite as long as Lucian did looking at human skin and flesh and faces and trying to translate them into paint. And he quite early on developed a rather unique method or attitude to the whole thing, which he described in a magazine article in 1954, so pretty well a lifetime ago, which, among other things, he said that it was important for the artist to keep the subject under observation all the time, 24 hours a day, if possible, so that the artist could discover everything about the subject, and from that totality of information, then extract what was useful for the picture. Sounds a little bit unnerving, that, but in practice, I'm showing you this early picture of strawberries. Goodness knows how he got soft fruit to pose for long enough to one of his pictures. But anyway, he had a lot of trouble with food. Eggs were easier. I'm showing you this because, in practice, what that observation meant was that it was absolutely compulsory and not much of a pain or a penance that for the sitter to go out to one of the best restaurants in London after the sitting so that Lucian could continue his observation. And also before, when I arrived at 6, the first thing we'd do is have a chat. Lucian would probably have a cup of tea at that stage, didn't drink before working. I might have a glass of wine. So we'd have a little bit of conversational interchange before the sitting began. And all the time, the idea was he could look at the sitter behaving, their features moving naturally. Because, I mean, sitting in a chair with your head cocked at just this angle is not a very natural activity. So he wanted to see as many different possible expressions which might be included in the work as he possibly could. So an example, about 7 months into this epic, I remember we were sitting in an Italian restaurant near Marble Arch, and he was quiet for a while. So I said, what are you thinking about? And he said, your left ear. So, of course, I wasn't the only sitter at the time. He had quite a schedule of sittings. I had colleagues, one of whom was this grey gelding mare, which was one of two horse subjects he had at the time, which his assistant David Dawson, who I believe has come here and spoken, had discovered in a stables in Wormwood Scrubs, which is a remote region of West London, in a stables run for some reason that I've never quite understood by nuns. But anyway, Lucian was able to work there quietly, and several mornings a week while he, at the beginning of when he was painting me, he would start off by painting the horses. There was also a skewbald mare, and this is the grey gelding, that I've got it right way around there. Consequently, he would often be very cold November, December, January. When I arrived, the first thing is he'd say is he was feeling a bit rough because he'd got frozen in the stables in the morning. And then usually, because I think work was sort of tonic for him, as he started painting, he'd start looking better. And David Hockney made the observation, Lucian looks younger when he's working. So this was a man whose work had a sort of positive feedback effect on him. There were the two horses. I'll come back to the skewbald mare in a moment. There's a connection between her and me. In the afternoons, the girl with fuzzy hair sometimes sat. And concerning her, there was a sort of warning or what had happened in her case indicated one of the potential pitfalls of a sitter for Lucian Freud, which is that she had sat for about 4 or 5 works, none of which had come to completion except this etching. Something had always gone wrong. Lucian had been unhappy with the work and put his foot through it or torn it up or something. Even this etching, a beautiful etching, I think, was almost destroyed, so there was a jinx at work by the acid in the print workshop, because when they put the plate in the acid to burn the lines, it started getting under the wax and it had to be pulled out quickly, so it's very lightly bitten. If you're a you're a print technician, you'll understand this. But so that was one worry, that Lucian might, you might sit for 7 months and he'd suddenly decide it wasn't good enough, put his foot through it, which would be discouraging, really, to the sitter. Another colleague I had, Andrew Parker Bowles, sitting in the, as you see, in the dress uniform of the commanding officer of a guards regiment. And there is a little another sort of warning for the sitter. He'd been sitting for quite a long time. So when I started, about a year, in fact, the picture had reached about his waist, sort of knees, and it's carried on for another 6 months or so until it reached the bottom of the canvas. And you didn't really meet the other sitters very much because they came at different times, but you heard a lot about them through the artist. And so I'd hear a lot about Andrew Parker Bowles, and when I met him, he said, "Yes, I've heard a lot about you." one of the things I heard about him is he's complaining his stomach sticks out too much. And it's Lucian talking to himself. And then pause. "I think I'll emphasize it a bit." So message to me that there's in this arrangement, there was no appeal at all. Could you change my nose a bit? Or could my eyebrows be a bit less bushy? Nothing. No, the artist had complete control. So one accepted that. By the way, this has a most unexpected precedent in a 19th century painting. I'll give you that clue. If anyone can get it, I'll be extremely impressed. Art historian.
Stevenson?
No, it's based on a Tissot. The James Tissot painting, about the last painter you would associate with Lucian Freud. But and I had predecessors, carrying on down the list. David Hockney had sat for a portrait the year before, 2002. There's one of David Dawson's great photographs, which had a slightly accidental aspect because he was actually intending, he tells me, just to photograph David's Hockney in his pose, and then Lucian opened the door and came in unexpectedly, as David Hockney said, "looking like a butcher." which brings up that apron he liked. It was another of his, part of his ritual, that he was always tearing off a bit of cloth and it's putting it into his belt. The idea was that it would protect his trousers from paint, and also he could wipe his brushes on it. As far as protecting his trousers was concerned, it didn't really work very well. And so you'd go to these very smart restaurants with him, almost always with lots of paint all over his trousers. And it looked very good, actually. He looked very... looked stylish, in a way. David Hockney said a good remark. Hockney thinks he posed for 130 hours, and then he adds, "and you can see the time layered into the picture." So there's an idea about Lucian Freud. It's actually the subject, in a way, is the time, all that time, all those different observations. My unfortunate remark, as it turned out, was I was just unwisely musing one evening in the studio. I said, "I wonder if the precedent of the picture of me you're doing was the one of David Hockney," when I was thinking we were sitting in the same chair, it's more or less the same angle and so forth. And Lucian said, "No, actually, I've always thought that it was the picture of the backside of the skewbald mare which led directly into your your painting," by which I think he had in mind the handling of the paint and that kind of thing. Another thing which the Hockney brings out is that it's called David Hockney, which is unusual for a Freud portrait, because most of them are called, like, Man with a Blue Scarf. Lucian actually didn't think the identity of the sitter was very important. Or rather, he felt all the information which was important was visual. So he generally, the titles are woman, man. And I didn't mind very much about turning into man with a blue scarf because the Duchess of Devonshire is woman with a white shirt. And Jacob Rothschild, who's one of the most richest and most powerful people in British cultural life, is man in a chair. And so, but art, he made an exception for artists. I think he perhaps thought artists were a bit more important than ordinary people. And they tend to get their own names. Just on the subject of anonymity, I'm showing you... This is an etching Lucinda did in, I think, 1992. It's of a book which he was given as a child by his grandfather, Sigmund. It's a history of Egypt in German. And he was he kept it, and he was particularly fond of these two plates, which he did also two paintings of these, which depict a couple of... Mars sort of clay, but I think possibly plaster portrait masks, which were found in the workshop of a sculptor in the city of Amarna in Middle Egypt in 1912. And the point about them is nobody knows who they were or anything about them at all, but, or I think Lucian's point to us is, but... they're still perfectly interesting to look at. And actually, if you think about it, a lot of the great paintings in galleries from the Renaissance and so forth, we don't really know anything very much about the people. Even the Mona Lisa, we just about know her name. So you don't need the extra information, it's all on the picture. I wanted to say a word or two about how Lucian's style changed, because there's a sort of feeling that, in a way, it's always the same, his work, whereas actually I think it's tremendously varied, and he made a great effort to make everything different, if he possibly could. And there was one huge change, which you'll see clearly in this exhibition here, which is that he started out as basically a linear artist. For the first 10, 15 years of his career, almost everything he produced actually was drawings, works on paper, and a few paintings. And for the second half of his career, almost everything he did, with the exception of etchings, was painting. So he deliberately, by an act of will, he transformed himself into a painter whose work involves thick impasto and brushwork and all that sort of thing. But this is Freud phase one. This is a picture of his... first wife. If you're thinking that that cat is being held in a rather aggressive way by by the by, Lucian didn't like cats. He had very strong he had very strong views about animals, positive and negative, which was actually exactly the same as his views about people. He loved horses and had a deep feeling for them from childhood. He got on okay with dogs. He owned dogs, but he had a feeling that he wasn't really the dog type, and dogs. He felt dogs needed somebody with a regular. With regular habits, and part of Lucian's idea about himself was that he didn't have habits. Actually, his life ran to an absolutely precise timetable, so it wasn't, but anyway, that was how he felt. Cats, he really resented the way they'd come and sit on your lap with an air of, now you may stroke me. So anyway, this is his first... this is sort of classic early Freud. Amazingly close observation. You feel he's got closer to that sitter than, you know, he's been looking at her through a microscope or a magnifying glass. In the original, you can see all the little marks in the irises of her eye and practically count her eyelashes and so forth. So tremendous surface detail. If we move forward about... 40 years. In a way, everything's changed. Here's Benefit's supervisor sleeping, which is a picture which for quite a while had the odd distinction of being the most expensive work ever sold by a living artist at auction. It was auctioned for not sure I can get the dollar sum in my head. It was £17.5 million, so at the time probably over $30 million anyway. Roman Abramovich and his companion bought it for their dining room, I believe. In a way, what he's doing here is exactly the same. It's close observation of an individual. I asked him what he was one day, I just happened to ask him what he was thinking about when he painted this model, Sue Tilly, who's the benefit supervisor, of whom there are a lot of pictures. And he said, I was thinking about the anatomy of the individual. And I think that gives you the big clue to what Lucien's work is always about. It's about individuals. Everyone's different. And even in still lives, he did a painting of five eggs. And after a while, he felt that the egg on the right had a slightly different personality to the egg next to it. But people, everything completely different. And consequently, for wearing clothes for sittings, you weren't even allowed to wear a shirt made by the same manufacturer in the same colour, because Lucien would feel it would be slightly different somehow. The collar would hang slightly differently, the sewing would be just a little bit different. So individuality was crucial to it. Another thing, this is his first wife again, looking a little bit more sort of careworn a few years later. Point I want to make about that is a lot of his work is about couples, and they're often actually animal-human couples. Some human-human couples, but very often one of his thoughts about art was that one of the most difficult things to do is to paint people together, by which he meant so that you felt that they were really spatially properly related, but also you could felt their relationship to each other. And that was one of the things, in his view, which divided pretty good artists from great artists. So, e.g., for example, Toulouse-Lautrec, in Lucien's opinion, couldn't paint people together. Degas could. Degas was a great artist. Toulouse-Lautrec, not so good. He had, in fact, very strong views about the art of the past, which were often unconventional. He thought somebody should write a book about what a bad artist Leonardo da Vinci was, and he thought Raphael couldn't draw. On the other hand, really loved Chardin. This is his favourite Chardin from the National Gallery in London, the young schoolmistress, about which Lucien had a huge number of thoughts, one of which was that the young schoolmistress has the most beautiful ear in art. Lucien was very interested in ears. You can see that in his picture. And he did a series of, you couldn't call them copies, they're sort of translations into Freudian terms of that picture. There are paintings and etchings. And you can see that the schoolmistress has become sort of strangely spiky and slightly sinister, and her pupil looks like the young Lee Bowery, and there's this sort of strange, stormy atmospheric forces swirling around them. Those were all the works were done not from photographs, but Lucien standing with his easel or his etching plate in the National Gallery after dark. He spent night after night after night standing in front of the picture. I'm going to stop quite soon to give you an opportunity to ask some questions. I'll just make one or two little quick points. One is about insight. There's a sort of old chestnut about portraiture, which is that the portrait painter sees into the inner self of the subject, which sounds a bit sort of slightly supernatural, strange idea. How could that happen? Here's an example where it might seem it did happen. This is a painting of an artist friend of Lucien's from the 50s, John Minton, painted in 1954. A few years after this was done, Minton committed suicide, which, when you look at the picture, doesn't seem surprising at all. But if you look at photographs of him, you see a good-looking, rather confident-looking young man. So I asked Lucien, how could you see what the camera couldn't see? And he said, well, it was perfectly easy. He didn't make any secret of the fact he was doomed. It was rather his shtick. You know, you'd go out to a restaurant with him and he'd say, waiter, bring us a bottle of Chateau Hysteria, please. And you know, he was carrying. So how did Lucien know? Because he knew him very well. It comes back to this observation. Another very lived-in face, the Soho photographer John Deakin, a member of the Francis Bacon Circle, very heavy drinker. I put him in partly because I think this is a rather marvellous portrait with insight, partly to demonstrate how Lucien's painting technique had changed over a decade. This is early 60s, I think 63, 64. It took 2 years. It looks as if it might have been painted in about an hour and a half, doesn't it? A little story about that, another pitfall for the sitter. After Deakin had been sitting for this for about 9 months, he came into a pub in Soho called the French House, which is a famous drinking hole of artists at the time, and slumped down at the bar, head in hands, in a state of utter despair. And his fellow drinkers said, what on earth's the matter, John? And he said, he's just decided to start all over again. Well, if he was pitiless in a way with his sitters, Lucien was quite as pitiless with himself. Here's an example of a picture which resurfaced recently. It's called Self-Portrait with Black Eye. It's unfinished, from the mid-70s. What had happened is, as quite often happened, Lucien spent his life essentially either in his studio or in restaurants or in taxis. And he had a lot of encounters with taxi drivers, and he had an altercation of some kind with the taxi cab driver, resulting in this black eye. And his immediate reaction, very typical, was to start a picture. And I imagine what had happened is the black eye went down, and after a while, so he stopped the picture. But seized on signs of his own aging and exaggerated it, in fact, I think, in this marvellous picture from 2002. A quick little story about that. When I was sitting, he had a dental crisis, and his dentist, I don't know what he was threatening him with, implants or something, but anyway, a lot had to be done to his front teeth. So Lucien told me at one sitting he decided that he just couldn't be bothered with all this dentistry. It was going to take up too much of his painting time. He'd just have no front teeth. And fine. And immediately he started thinking of... He would start a picture called Self-Portrait with No Front Teeth. Which could have been a masterpiece, actually. So in a way, it's unfortunate that when he went back to his dentist was horrified and apparently had a plan B, which he hadn't mentioned before, and it wasn't necessary, and the painting didn't happen. Lucien is sometimes thought to be a pitiless observer. I don't think that's true at all. I think there's a good deal of sympathy and compassion, but he's not. There's no illusion in his gaze. This is an interesting example of, I think, a rather tender painting. The subject he described as a very clever bank robber he happened to know in the 60s, when there were quite a few criminals in his circle of acquaintance. But from this man, he must have been a fairly tough case professionally. In fact, he himself had had some sort of professional disagreement with some of his colleagues amongst bank robbers, which had caused the quite heavy facial scarring you can see. But Lucien turned him into a subject for a sort of study in parenthood, father and daughter, which, I think is a tender painting. I don't know if you have the same expression in the United States. In England, we say about buses that, you know, you wait for 45 minutes and then three come along all at the same time. And in a way, it's the same with great English painters, perhaps. You know, you have Constable and Turner, you wait for 150 years, and then Freud and Bacon come along, both together. There they are, both standing in Soho, in the street, in, I should think, from the look of Bacon's Macintosh, 1970, early 70s, maybe. The one thing about they had a good deal in common. I think Bacon gave a huge example for Lucian of how to live the life of an artist. He apparently saw Francis Bacon every day for 25 years for at some point lunch, dinner, breakfast. But they're very different. Bacon was a quick painter, Lucian a very slow painter. Bacon didn't like working from the live model very much. He did it occasionally. Lucian would not work without the live model present. To the extent I probably haven't mentioned, he wouldn't paint the empty air above my head unless I was there. Nothing. And that would apply to everyone. The Queen is the only person I know, sitter, who was let off that. She had somebody else wore the crown for her picture, which may explain why it's not as good as it might otherwise have been. Anyway, so and one other strange thing about Bacon and Freud is Lucian was great at painting Bacon. There's a succession of very good paintings and drawings of Bacon. Whereas I thought Bacon painted Lucian something like 15 times, and none of them are all that good. And he wasn't a good subject for Bacon. All I think Bacon ever succeeded in capturing was his impatience. Lucian was a very impatient man. He used to say, "All my patience has gone into my art." So I'm just going to stop at this point, and I'm going to leave you with a little question for you, the audience, for giving you an opportunity to ask me some questions. My question is, here are the three of us again, him, me, and it, and the question is, in looking at the picture of me by him, do you find out more information about him, the artist, or me, the sitter? Thank you. So, if anyone's got a question.
Martin has agreed to.
The Queen, where did she sit? The Queen, where did she sit for painting?
The Queen.
The Queen.
Oh, the Queen, yes. Where did she keep? Oh, sorry.
Where did she sit for the painting?
Oh, right. Well, that is an interesting question, actually. The idea. Initially, and what Lucian would have much preferred, was that the Queen would arrive in an unmarked van outside his studio in Kensington, get out of the back of it wearing a scarf over her head and an overcoat, and run across the pavement into his studio. But unfortunately, the newspapers got hold of this information, and then her security people told her that she couldn't do that, so it had to be done in St. James's Palace instead, which wasn't as satisfactory.
Over?
Well, that was before, this happened before it began.
Okay. Hyde asked if that meant that he had to start the painting over. You would think that perhaps he would, given his
yes.
Inclination. So.
Well, the Queen is a difficult subject because she's so busy, and although she gave him more sittings than most painters uh-huh. get, making her turn up three nights a week for 9 months seemed to be out of the question.
Michael?
Martin, what is it about your portrait that you least like?
Least like? That's a tricky one. Well, I think it's probably the Dorian Gray answer. I don't like the fact it stays the same age, and I don't.
What is it that you learned about yourself from the painting that you wouldn't have learned from looking at a photograph of yourself?
Interesting. Well, I suppose one thing I found, because it's a work of art by Lucian Freud rather than a sort of essay about me, is I was interested that at any rate, partially and some of the time, that was how Lucian saw me. And actually, I was rather surprised as the picture started to develop by what a sort of big, confident-looking person he saw me as being, whereas, you know, I didn't necessarily feel like that, especially, you know, 9:30 at night after a long day sitting there in that dark studio and he'd gone downstairs to make himself a cup of tea. I felt that thing's a lot stronger than I am.
Did you carry on conversations while you were sitting there? Was it quiet?
He was happy to talk. In fact, I think he had what probably you know, Gainsborough and Goya and all the great portrait painters had, which was a professional skill at keeping the sitter entertained. It's part of the necessary panoply for a portrait painter. What I worked out early on was that there was a trade-off. Lucien would have talked virtually all the time if I primed him to do so. However, he didn't paint while he was talking. So if he talked all the time, the sittings would carry on forever.
Yeah, that's fine. That's
great. During the whole process, there's such an intensity. After the completion of the painting, how did the relationship between you and Lucien change? And did it slowly evaporate, or were you able to maintain a relationship after completion of the portrait?
Well, a good question. Well, there are two answers. After the painted portrait, I went straight on to do an etching, to the extent that we'd sort of decided that it was going to finish on a certain evening, and my wife and children were going to come to his studio, and we were going to go out to dinner. And so Lucien thought if he had a spare quarter of an hour before they arrived, he'd immediately start on the etching. So in a way, there wasn't a pause after the painting. After the etching, then it stopped. And the answer to that, the wider question, is that while you were sitting for him, you had the slightly intoxicating feeling that you were, just while you were sitting and while he was looking at you, the most important person in the world, as far as he was concerned. You had an absolute laser-like beam of attention focused on you, which was a seductive feeling. But on the other hand, the whole process was pretty exhausting. So as far as I was concerned, the whole thing sort of evened out. I was a bit deflated, but on the other hand, I was a bit relieved when it stopped. And because I'd had a very sort of straightforward relation of friendship before, we went back to that, in fact. But it certainly the intensity went ramped up when the sitting started, and then went back to status quo ante.
Yeah. Was the painting supposed to, were you supposed to own it, or was it just going to be a portrait?
It never crossed my mind. No, I was interested in what happened. I wanted to step through the looking glass and see what happened in the artist's studio. It was probably, I don't know, $3 million out of the studio, out of my league, and a bit much to expect Lucien to make a present of what was, you know, probably about 30% of his year's work.
And who owns it now?
It's owned by a private collector in California.
Oh, interesting.
Did he talk about art in general, or painting, or about his own painting, or his...
All of those, and also what was in the evening newspaper, and what the assistant in the butcher shop had said to him that afternoon.
And so what would he say about his painting or other painters?
Well, it's difficult to know where to start with that. We talked about the classic art of the past quite a lot. I told you a bit about who he didn't like. I mean, but there are an awful lot of painters he loved, particularly French painting. He loved French painting so much that if he liked a painter who wasn't French, he made them an honorary Frenchman. So Titian was a French painter as far as well, I think Tissot probably nothing except the pose. It's the long red stripe on the trousers and the long legs, and which I think had caught his eye. But with Courbet, for example, who's a very important artist, I mean, it was the sense of weight and flesh and presence, and that's what he liked. And if that wasn't there, for example, in Vermeer, he was ambivalent about. In a way, his people just aren't there. And he didn't like that. He liked the feeling you could reach out and touch them and lift them up, and they were heavy and all that.
You said that he moved to the etching immediately after the painting. Was that typical?
If a portrait had gone well, he usually liked to do an etching afterwards, as soon as possible. And there was an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York a few years ago called The Painter's Etchings, which paired up the painted portraits and the etched portraits as a sort of compare and contrast exercise.
And what was that time frame?
Oh, that was another 8 months. that started in July.
Wow.
Oh
my. Martin, we have one right here.
I noticed he doesn't seem to sign his paintings.
Yes, he disapproved of signatures. And he said that, it's a funny story about this, he'd asked his grandfather when Sigmund Freud moved to London at the end of his life to sign an anarchist's party petition. With Lucent being a supporter of the anarchists at that stage and probably always. And Sigmund Freud had said he wouldn't, and that he disapproved of signing things, and he said, "Beware the cult of the signature, my boy." And Lucent really took this to heart. He didn't like, he thought signing things was bogus, but he had to sign his etchings. LF, very delicate little letter.
Did he have a chance to read an early draft of your...
Yes, I sent it to him and David Dawson, and I didn't get any sort of... well, actually, David pointed out one or two little factual things, but generally he seemed... I was never quite sure what he thought about it. I know he liked the reviews, because I went to see him when it came out, and the Mail on Sunday had got gossip, sadist, genius... It scream headlines at the top of the review, and I saw this paper. It was open on the model's bed, so he's obviously admiring this. Hi. Yes.
The famous blue scarf. I mean, I've got to know the genesis and is of it, and what's the material made of?
it's wool. It's
fine Italian wool or cashmere.
I would think it's probably. British wool, and it's you get them from a shop on Trinity Street in Cambridge.
Gary?
You know, I notice in your book there's an awful lot of things that Freud said in quotes.
Yeah.
And a night sitter, it seemed like very often there's dinner after the sitting.
Almost always, yes.
And a commute home.
Yes.
And I would just like you to expand on the process of gathering your material. You know, did you go home and getting home at 2 o'clock in the morning, then make an entry?
I would write sometimes on the train. Does anyone here read Rex Stout detective stories? I'm a bit of a fan of Rex Stout. Well, in that case, you'll know Nero Wolfe, who's the detective. In Rex Stout has an assistant, Archie Goodwin, and because Nero Wolfe doesn't like going out, Archie Goodwin has to go and talk to all the suspects and investigate and come back and repeat conversations verbatim to Nero Wolfe. And up to a point, I think if you know you've got to remember a conversation, you can keep it, but not for long. A day or two, after a week or two, it starts to go, I found. But I mean, sometimes Lucien would start something. He would say, "When I was in Paris in 1915, I went to see Picasso," and I'd think, "You've got to remember what he says now, and try and concentrate hard."
I really appreciated what you said in the book about Freud and what you observed about an artist having to employ memory just
yes.
from the point of looking to the canvas.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was so interesting and.
I think there's a lot of memory in art. Hockney makes that point. There was somebody in there.
Does he listen to music
No. Okay. No, Lucien felt he wasn't very musical, though he did actually, I've thought his taste in the jazz concert that he went to was spot on, actually. He just had a sort of intuitive feeling for what was good.
Maybe one more? Yes, sir?
Back to the scarf and the color.
Yeah.
There didn't seem to me to be a good match between your scarf and the painted scarf. Was he short on blues?
Well, it's probably, if you hold it up against the canvas, it's not exactly the same, but the whole thing had been modulated, I suppose.
It's more of a cobalt blue. Yeah,
there's more of an ultramarine. But you've seen it in the gallery. Right?
Yes. I think that's probably not giving an accurate connection.
Not that.
Yes. The real one is, it's. I think he did sort of shift it a little bit. Yes, I think he did.
I think we're going to let that be it for the evening. Thank you so much.